Text 51551. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, this time around 4 years ago, our next guest, Abby Morgan, was doing Desert Island Discs and talking to Kirsty Young about her career as a screenwriter, talking about working on The Iron Lady, the biopic of Margaret Thatcher, winning Emmys and BAFTAs. Little did she know that a couple of months later that her life was about to take a huge dramatic twist that would be worthy of any of her screenplays. And she writes about the twist and the 4 years after, or 3 years after, in her new memoir, This Is Not a Pity Memoir. And Abby Morgan joins us on the line from London. Good afternoon, Abby.
Hi, Roy. Ray. Thanks for having me on the show. Yeah. Sorry, just the sound went. Hi. Yeah.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Congratulations on the book, and I know it's your life, and it's not a work of fiction, but it reads like a work of fiction sometimes, and that wasn't lost on you, was it?
No, I mean, I think, you know, I'm a screenwriter by trade, so actually very quickly I was seeing everything in forms of scenes, and consultants were talking in dialogue, and, yeah, you know, moments of kind of medical crisis were plot twists. So I think it was the way I kind of preserved my sanity, actually. It was just to go back to all the skills that I'd honed over the last 20 years.
And for that reason, there's loads of humour in it, because you have this internal editor which along the way is editing large pieces of your life out of a book or a movie that might come in the future.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's always, I always had that voice. I mean, you know, what happened to me was so left of field, and what happened to us as a family. I think I just drew on everything I knew and started to think, well, actually, how do I keep track of this? How do I hold on to this? You know, it was so extraordinary and it was so unexpected that I think, you draw on the talents that you have just to survive it.
To remain sane. So it was May 2018, you were on Desert Island Discs.
Yes.
And then in June of that year, your
yes.
partner, your longtime partner, father of your two children, Jesse and Mabel, he collapsed. Now, he suffers with MS. And at the beginning, you just thought it was another episode.
Yeah, I think it was. I thought it was a bit of man flu, actually.
Right.
I think I threw a packet of paracetamol at him and ran downstairs. But you know, you're right. It was. I'd just done Desert Island Discs, and it took me a long time to listen to that again, actually, because obviously I spoke quite a lot about my family, in particular about Jacob and my relationship. But June 2018, I'd gone out for the morning. He had a headache, and when I came back, having done my school run and pick up of coffee and just generally self-absorbed with myself, I came home and found Jacob collapsed on the bathroom floor, and so ensued the kind of start of what's been nearly 3.5 years now of yeah. life-changing kind of medical catastrophe.
And I've listened back to your Desert Island Discs, and it's not smugness, but you were definitely happy with your lot.
Absolutely.
At that stage.
I think absolutely. I'm really pleased you've listened to that, Ray, because I think it really puts context to the book. But yeah, in many ways, I think I felt very lucky. I mean, I think Jake and I used to kind of feel this sense of, wow, we're okay, we're on dry land. And I definitely think that comes through in the interview. And also, when you reflect on your life in that way, you always are going to pull out the good bits, aren't you? You're always going to, that's one of the things I learned was about the brand of family and how much I'd lent into the kind of brand of how it had to look. And, you know, with Jacob collapsing, you know, he collapsed, and very quickly it became apparent that, you know, cognitively, psychiatrically, physically, he was unraveling. And so within a couple of weeks, it was, you know, apparent that Jacob needed to be placed into a medically induced coma, which
Will
he went
to. Explain to me why they put people in an induced coma?
Well, I mean, Jacob, you know, it took a long time to work out what was wrong with Jacob, but he was basically repetitively seizuring, which means that, you know, your body, your whole electrical nervous system is under fire. And so as they tried to work out what was wrong with him, they realized that he had developed a rare form of encephalitis called anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis. And the reason why they decided to put Jacob in a medically induced coma is that his body was getting to a point that just the basic mnemonic function, you know, breathing, swallowing, you know, blinking, was just becoming really, really hard for him. And so the decision was to taken to put him into this coma as a way that they could then medically work on trying to, you know, resolve his encephalitis and stop his seizuring.
So it sort of pauses bodily functions, does it?
Totally. It's like going into you're anaesthetised like you are in an operation state, but it's just an extended operation state. And boy, oh boy, was it extended with this one, because, you know, he went in the start of, end of June 2018, and he woke end of January 2019.
7 months or thereabouts.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of time to think and reflect and, you know, sit by someone's hospital bed and you know, think about life and your relationship, I guess.
Yeah. And there's lovely moments in your memoir about how ye meet. It was a whirlwind romance, wasn't it?
It really was, actually. You know, I met Jacob in November and then pursued him via email that had just come in for a couple of months. And then we started seeing each other in January, and then I was pregnant by April. So we very quickly, you know, evolved into a relationship. And then we had our first son, Jesse. And then a couple of years later, Mabel came along.
Yeah. Kindred spirits, it strikes me just from reading it. But again, you only include the good bits. No, that's not true, because you didn't. You include some of the bad bits as well. But,
yeah. Totally. I think I was, you know, I tried to be as brutal. I tried to, you know, it's a brutal experience, but I think the person I was most brutal about was myself, really, because it caused, you know, I think Jacob, no one tells you about the activity around a coma. You know, ultimately, everybody's working, you know, there are nurses doing medication, and there's a constant kind of team of therapists who are moving someone while they sleep. So while this was going on, I had a lot of time to sort of sit and observe and think about Jacob and actually think about myself and how I'd been as a partner and how I'd been as a mother and how I was as a person. And I guess that's what the whole experience taught me, really, was this sort of self-reflection.
And what did you learn from that?
Well, I guess I've learned that I became as fascinated with myself as I was with the character in a movie. You know,
right.
I started to sort of realize that actually this was, you know, what was happening to us was a great drama. But I guess also, you know, there was another plot twist when Jacob woke up.
Yes,
which is,
well, I'm going to get to that. We've plenty of time.
Yeah.
you're moving it on now, like, because that's the screenwriter in you.
I guess it is. Yeah. I guess it is. And I think you're right. You know, I think you're totally right. I suppose I feel like I'm occupying quite a lot of space talking about the story at the moment. And I think in many ways, I'm genuinely surprised and relieved that people are responding so well to it, because I think I felt, you know, certainly as the book came out, I felt that feeling, you know, I've talked about this, but I felt that feeling a little bit like when you get drunk and the next morning you think, what have I said? You know,
yeah.
So I guess,
okay,
the fact that, you know.
Well, then when he came out of the coma and it wasn't like movie-like, as in he didn't sit up and function normally. It was slow process, quite awkward. He grunted a few words. And then this happened. Was it Valentine's Day 2019?
Yeah, around about Valentine's Day, Jacob had been awake for about a month, and I'd started to notice that his reaction to me was slightly different to the way he reacted to everyone else. He was obviously pleased and delighted and very relaxed with everyone else, but there was a certain formality with me. And on Valentine's Day, I decided to kind of surprise him with a bright red, very cheesy cellophane balloon heart, and I tied it to his bed and kind of looked at him with expectation, thinking he'd think it was quite funny. And he was encouraged by the nurse to give me a red rose, which they had bought every, you know, all the families on the ward, which was very sweet. But when she, you know, when the nurse said, you know, say hello to your wife, give the rose to your wife, you know, he said, she's not my wife. And I think, you know, I mean, one of two things. Technically, he was kind of right because we weren't married then. But also, I think you grasp at straws at that point. But, you know, then very rapidly, I realized that Jake had developed this rare delusion called Capgras delusion, which you normally see in dementia patients, or after a traumatic brain injury, say a car crash, which is when you believe someone or something close to you is an imposter. And the focus of that delusion was on me, and that I was someone else. I wasn't, as Jacob put it, the real Abby Morgan.
You say in the book, it's not that he's forgotten me. He doesn't know me, can't locate me.
Exactly. It's you know, I looked different to the Abby Morgan he had in his head. The Abby Morgan in his head had long dark hair and blue eyes, and I had shoulder length brown hair at the time and brown eyes, you know. So she was a very much a different person. And when you questioned and you said, you know, where is this Abby Morgan then? He said, she's gone to live with someone else.
That's horrific, Abby.
Yeah, it is. I mean, when I hear myself say it now, I know I'm sort of, it still shocks me. And I think that's one of the experiences of talking about the book, is in many ways it's still quite live. But
the fact that, you know, he described this other woman, you know, long hair, blue eyes, taller than you are.
She sounded great. Yeah, she really did. I mean,
but was there jealousy on your part for this whatever figment of his imagination?
I think there was less jealousy for her. I mean, I was sort of, I was more just kind of, I think where I became very kind of passionate was my indignation about not being recognised. You know, I think I'd felt like I'd spent the last sort of 6-7 months keeping our lives, our house, our children's lives together, and, you know, being there for our families, both our families, who are brilliantly supportive through this. And so for him to wake up and not know me, I mainly felt indignant and actually quite humiliated. It's humiliating when something like this happens to you, and I was kind of surprised. That comes back to the smugness again, you know.
Yes.
I had my pride punctured, you know. It was humiliating for to be turned away and out of the room by a nurse. Or
and this is very rare, this CAPGRAS delusion.
Capgras. It is. As I said, you know, it is seen in dimension. I think I found a huge, you know, I felt a huge connection with anyone who's experienced that. You know, I found many stories of people whose, you know, elderly relatives or, you know, mothers, fathers, even husbands were going through dementia, and that this was their response. But I hadn't found anybody, bar a couple of little bits of footage I found on the internet. But I couldn't find anything.
Now here comes a bit of your internal editor, and so April June of that year, you're not feeling well. And it's one of those situations where you would say, and anybody would say, if they saw it in a movie, no, this doesn't happen in real life.
You're totally right. And I was really annoyed at the time when this thing happened. So basically in about, I think it's all about trying to control the narrative and trying to control something uncontrollable. And I developed a pain in my left breast, and I just put it down to driving every day, and it was my seatbelt rubbing, or maybe it was just the excessive amounts of caffeine and, you know, Mars bars chocolate I was stuffing in my face. But a friend said, look, just go and get it checked out. And I did. And you know, within 10 minutes of actually meeting the breast surgeon, and he told me that he was 99% sure I had breast cancer. And that was confirmed in a couple of weeks. So I was kind of reeling from this, but at the same time I was thinking, that is such a bad plot twist. That's such a cliche. You know, I've already had one cliche, which is, you know, Jacob wakes up and he doesn't know me. And I've seen that in movies, and, you know, and it's not like it is in movies, I can tell you. And then this happened, and I felt, you know, cancer's massive. It felt like it was worthy of a film of its own. So for them to come together, I mainly felt initially, I think that was the shock again, I felt infuriated by it.
You have a black sense of humour.
Black. It's got darker and darker, I can tell you, through this.
Yes, and I suppose it was a survival mechanism as well, wasn't it, for you, that dark humour?
Absolutely, and I think anybody who's gone through it, you know, experience, certainly, it's incredible. You know, we know that the NHS are heroes, and they've been incredible the last couple of years. But when you're on a ward, you know, it's so bleak some days that you have to laugh, and it's amazing actually how much humour and laughter there is actually.
And times which seems unbelievable, you forgot, and you said it's in the book probably for dramatic effect, but that you forgot that you had cancer, because you'd be discussing Jacob's future with doctors, as in bringing him home after rehab and all that sort of thing. And then they would have to remind you, but will you be capable of doing this because you have cancer?
I think that was denial and a survival mechanism. But also I became very practical with it. You know, I felt like my children were one parent down, and I was really shaken by the thought that they could be two. That just felt too much, you know. So I guess I'd drawn everything, the friendship and the support of my family and friends.
Jacob's prognosis was pretty stark.
It was pretty bleak, you know. I certainly through the coma period, we had several life and death moments. And then when he woke up, you know, it became apparent there was a lot for him to relearn. And certain, you know, what Jacob didn't have, and it became evident quite quickly, is he had no sense of agency or initiation. And so, you know, not only he didn't know who I was, but he didn't know how to communicate that. You know, you had to really probe him, you had to really push him, and you also had to probe him and push him to do anything.
So was he acting like a child, or how would you describe how he was acting, this man that you brought home with you?
Oh, well, I mean, that, you know, I think anybody who's been in ITU or has had a medical catastrophe, when you bring someone home, the rehab really, you know, you think you've done the rehab at hospital, but it starts at home. So when we brought him home, I kind of hoped that the house would help him kind of realign and reconnect. And he was very silent. I mean, honestly, he was very quiet. He was very silent. He'd started to regain movement, which was great. But still, you know, he had certain paralysis and he needed, you know, at that time, 24-hour care. So I think I remember just before he arrived back, I had to video the house so that we could, you know, show the hospitals how it would work and how he could move around the house. But also I showed it to him. And I remember him looking at the video of his house and me walking through it, all the scuff paintwork and, you know, familiar bit objects around the house. And he looked at it with kind of quiet fascination. That for a while I thought maybe he would reject the house, but actually when he came home, I think that started to really place him, and he very quickly sort of found his place at home. But I think as a family, we were, you know, I say about it in the book, you know, you're bringing home a stranger is not a stranger at all. You know, that's the strange thing, is that you know this person, and yet as much as I was a stranger to him, he was also in many ways a stranger to me and to my children.
Wow. And were you constantly or occasionally quizzing him about who you were and what you were to him?
Well, it's funny because, you know, the neuropsychiatrists work on this theory A, theory B.
Right, go on.
Idea, which, so theory A is, so, you know, you present it to Jacob, you know, theory A, Jacob, you're absolutely right, this is not Abby Morgan. But theory B, you know, we can never be 100% sure. So let's say 99% this is not Abby Morgan, but just say there's that 1%. And the idea is that you build every day that 1%, so it goes up to 5 and then 10 and then 15. And it never ever worked. Jacob stuck resolutely at absolutely not. And so I just threw that out, really, and I did anything I could to provoke Jake. I would, you know, he'd put his porridge bowl down, I'd move it across the island for him. I would constantly ask him a question and then know about something that he liked, and then I'd know the answer to it to try and surprise him. And he would, so I did anything to really get his attention. Jolt him out of it, but also, you know, someone said early on, and I remember feeling I wanted to sort of smack them in the mouth when they said it, but they said, you know, well, I suppose the silver lining is, you know, you can fall in love again. And I remember at the time feeling really angry that, like, that's not going to happen. But actually it was a process of sort of trying to court Jacob again. You know, I took him out for tea, I took him out for lunch, I sat with him and watched his favourite programmes, I kind of tried to connect, I played a lot of Scrabble, you know, I did everything I could, and we as a family did everything
courtship.
In a way, yeah. And in a way, you know, whilst that was going on, I was also just reflecting on, you know, what kind of partner had I been and how had we got here?
And there must have been moments where you went, and you say it in the book, that you wish he had died on some occasions.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. That's the hardest thing for me to hear read back to myself.
Right, okay.
But I said it, and I think, you know, I said it because there were times where it was really hard. It was really tough. You know, it was very tough to, you know, one of the things that Jake developed was this idea that I worked for the state and that I'd been employed by the state to look after him and his children. And we sort of fell into that at the beginning, and then it evolved into friendship. And actually that friendship state was the one where I think I, you know, my empathy and my love for Jacob started to kick in, and it became less about him recognising me, but more about me helping him recognise himself, I guess, because that's what I realised more than anything, is that he couldn't remember me, but then it was really himself he couldn't remember anymore. You know, I was taking him out to see a consultant one day, and there was a kind of careful mechanics of leaning Jake up against the wall and, you know, managing to get his coat on him while you kind of turn around quickly to get your car keys. And as I turned around, I saw he caught his reflection in the hallway mirror, and I said, "Who is that?" And he said, "I don't know." And I said, "That's Jacob."
Wow.
And as soon as I realised he'd forgotten himself, it helped me reframe the experience.
There's so many sort of moments in the book that'll stop you in your tracks. And you, because of your cancer, your breast cancer, had to have a mastectomy.
Yeah.
And the morning you're going out to get get your breast removed, you shared this with Jacob. Well, you see, you're laughing. You see, that's.
I'm laughing because you're the first. You're the first one who's been bold enough to raise that one. And I'm quite impressed. I'm quite impressed with you, Ray. Really. Yes, I did. I mean, you know, what does a woman do when she's about to lose her breast, and the only other person who really knows your breast is your husband? I thought, well, maybe he'd like to have a look at it. Maybe just like to wave it off. And he looked at me with such horror.
Disdain. Yeah.
Just disdain. And then when I pushed, I said, why do you not want to see it? And he said, well, she wouldn't like it. And I knew who, and I said, who wouldn't like it? And he said, Abby Morgan. And I guess that was the moment where I thought, well, I'm kind of got to go out and do this on my own and think about how we move on when I get back, you know.
But it's an odd, I'd be the first one to slag off big tech companies, but it, like Apple saved the day, and those photographs that they throw up on your iPhone and your iPad.
So much so. Yeah, I mean, I think the digital age has been just absolutely vital. I mean, the digital age was how, you know, actually it was my son who found out about CapGraph, for example, but also it was, you know, this huge digital library you have of your life together. Yeah. And so every day there was, you know, a memory would pop up on the screen, and that was also, I suppose, part of, on Jake's iPad, when he would be reading his iPad in the morning, you know, there'd be another memory and it would be a holiday or a Christmas or a, and one day a photo of him and I popped up, and I did this kind of, I remember, you know, I was unafraid to embarrass and humiliate myself in front of Jacob. And so I would sort of look at the photo and then look at my face and point to my face and look at the photo and hope he would go, oh yeah, I get it. And he looked like he wasn't going to. And then just as I turned away, he said, yes, I'm starting to think there are similarities. And that was in the March 2020. So it took just over a year of sort of slowly rehab and being at home and slowly chipping away, and I guess just showing Jacob that to helping that kind of, you know, the other thing is that, you know, a doctor said to me, you know, they've told me this cap girl is not going to go after 3 months. If it's not gone after 3 months, it's going to stay. And I said, you know, I suppose it's like dementia patients. And the consultant said, well, no, but you know, dementia is all about decline and brain injury is about repair. And I think one of the things I take away from this is just how incredible the brain is and its ability to repair.
So to you first, you're cancer-free.
Cancer-free now, 2 years, just coming up to 2 years cancer-free, yeah.
Which is amazing. And just as a little, by the way, they're great because you're a screenwriter. There are, the book is littered with amazing movie references. My favorite is when you and him are going through similar, or maybe it's just you going through the cancer treatment. You refer to yourself as one of the de-wigged witches from Roald Dahl's The Witches, which is a very good, because that's quite a scary image, isn't it?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So along the way, he was 5% of his former self, and there's going to have to be a new chapter, isn't there, at the end of the book?
Yeah, I mean, I try and leave the book on a hopeful note, and actually, you know, it's, you know, I end the book in March 2021, and you know, what I can say is that Jacob in the last 6 months has made an astonishing recovery in a way that none of us could have expected or hoped for, and I feel, you know, that yeah, absolutely, there's another year's worth of material, really.
Brilliant?
It's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing, and I think we're all still trying to recalibrate. But you know, to give you an idea of it, you know, we just had a launch for the book, and I didn't expect him to come, and he surprised me at the end, and he got himself there and arrived, and it was the most amazing moment because you know there were people at the launch who hadn't seen him for nearly 4 years, so that was an amazing thing to see him back and see him, his wit and his humour and his joy for life starting to come back.
Brilliant, and that's a man who some of the doctors said would be incontinent for life.
Yeah, I mean, I think the expectation was that, you know, the damage that had been done was so severe that it would radically impair in his life. I mean, he's definitely still got a way to go, but I would say we're looking at 80% of the man now, which is pretty impressive, I think.
So quickly, because we're running out of time, I could talk to you for another half hour at least. Will there be a movie, and will it be Olivia Colman playing you, and who will play Jacob?
Oh, this is what everybody's trying to trip me up on. I would love to make a movie. I mean, I've just started directing on this. Obviously, I write the split, so I've just been directing on that. I'd love to make a movie on it, but let's try and sell the book, shall we?
Right, well,
and actually, a dream
cast. I think it
sells
itself. This is not a pity memoir. Go on, the dream cast.
Oh my gosh, I'm not even going to give names, just lots of amazing actors.
Well, you do
That's
mention Olivia
say.
Coleman in the book, so
when
you're
many,
fantasizing, yeah, right. Abby Morgan, thank you very much. This is Not a Pity Memoir is in bookshops now. Highly recommend it from here. Thanks, Abby. Mind yourself.
Thanks, Ray. Bye, thanks for having me on.
Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.